So hello and welcome to episode 4 of Think You Know the Presidents, and I'm Lise Hand.
I'm Flora McCarthy, and today we're taking a look at Erskine Childers, who was President of Ireland for just 1 year, Lise, 1973 until 74. It was terribly short and it was really tragic. It's one of the reasons we're looking into how in the name of God did we fit 4 presidents into just one decade, the 1970s.
I mean, last time we waved goodbye to Eamon de Valera when he finally exited in June 1973. But the next 2 presidents' terms were just really different. I mean, they were both cut very, very short. One tragically and one massively dramatically. And mercifully, the last of the quartet made it safely out of the 70s and lasted all the way to the 80s.
He did, and he was steadying the ship, is what it was said, wasn't it? But anyway, we're getting ahead of ourselves. Let's take a look at Erskine Hamilton Childers. And spoiler alert, his dad plays a huge part in this story. Think James Bond with a flair for writing. And I nearly forgot to introduce our special guest, Liz Gillis, historian extraordinaire. You're back.
We're back.
Hooray. The girls are back. The band is back together again.
I'm greatly honoured here today by the attendance of so many distinguished personages. I appreciate your presence, and I am sincerely grateful to you all. This has been a most moving ceremony for me, particularly because June the 25th is the anniversary of my father's birthday. I am humbly aware of the great honor conferred upon me at this ceremony. I know that I will need the prayers of the people for God's guidance in the performance of my duties.
So, Flora, here we have yet another Irish president who wasn't born in Ireland. He was born in London. He was born to a very, very wealthy family, and he went to posh schools. And
Chelsea boy.
He certainly was a Chelsea boy, yeah. And, you know, this is somebody who spent their summers swanning around the family estate down in Glendalough. And I saw one lovely piece of footage of him where he was talking about seeing fairies in the garden when he was a little boy of 7, which I thought was really,
yeah,
it was kind of cute.
A kind of an idyllic, charmed childhood, wasn't it? In his imagination.
Very much so. But then, of course, you know, like, I suppose, maybe boys of that class of that time, I mean, he was actually packed off to boarding school at a very, very tender age as well. Mm. And it was one of those boarding schools that was very, you know, it was quite upper class. I mean, they had people going there like, you know, the poet W.H. Auden, and they had the future founder of the BBC, Lord Reith. So this would have been very much king and empire kind of place as well. And
how
he was very young.
Them?
Well, I think it probably made him a little bit, he was probably very much torn because, you know, we'll hear a bit later, obviously, a good bit about his father. But so I think he was probably very much torn between the fact that he was brought up in England and he was going to this very, you know, posh public school. And yet he was hearing this other side of Irish history when he came over to Ireland and when he obviously was talking to his father.
So he had this charmed early life as a little boy with the fairies and the Wicklow hills.
Well, I mean, it was a very privileged upbringing. I mean, this was a guy who really, you know, had an extraordinary background. You know, his mother...
She was American.
Yeah, his mother, Molly Osgood. I mean, she was actually a descendant of the second president of the United States, John Adams, and her family were one of these, you know, posh American aristocracy that came over on the Mayflower. And it was her literal ancestral home, this gorgeous house down in Glendalough with beautiful grounds and gardens that he spent an awful lot of his time.
Yeah, very privileged existence so far. But then at the age of 16, everything changed. Everything came crashing down for him.
Can I go back and tell you about his dad? Because you cannot talk about the life of Erskine Childers Jr. without talking about the life of Robert Erskine Childers, known as Erskine Childers. And he is huge because he is, as you said in the introduction, like this James Bond figure. His life is caught between two islands, one being England and one being Ireland. So he fights with the English against the Boers in the Boer War. Then he and his wife, who are totally radicalised to Irish politics because you have the connection with Ireland.
So they started off being fighting for the empire.
Oh yeah, he's fighting for both. He goes backwards and forwards quite a lot. But he and his wife, Molly, are the ones to actually import the guns from Germany for the Haute gun run. And these guns are actually unabused by the volunteers, the rebels, in 1916. This is during the First World War, which then he goes back to England and joins the forerunner of the RAF. He writes one of the all-time great spy novels, The Riddle of the Sands. But when the war ends, he comes back to Ireland and throws in his lot with the Republicans who are trying to fight against the Empire and, you know, make Ireland a republic. Brilliant director of propaganda. That is his real, real forte. But then at the end of the War of Independence, we have the truce, which leads to the treaty negotiations. Ireland sends a delegate. There's a bit of tension here because he was actually feeding back information to Dev, because Dev doesn't go, famously doesn't go yeah. as part of the treaty delegation. And when the treaty is signed, that cements the partition of Ireland. Erskine Childress comes back with the delegation. The Dáil meets. The Dáil have to vote on this issue and they narrowly accept the treaty. But Sinn Féin split as a result of this, and Erskine Childress is one of the key figures in the anti-treaty Sinn Féin. Later, he sides with the anti-treaty IRA in the Civil War. Now, tragically, in the Civil War, he is arrested.
November 1922.
And this is crucial, this date, because by that time, the new Irish government had introduced legislation that meant if you're found with a gun, you could actually be executed. So...
And this wasn't any particular gun, sure. I mean, this was a special gun, wasn't it?
This was actually given by two Erskine Childress as a gift by Michael Collins.
Is that true?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And of course, you know, Michael Collins, I mean, he was probably one of the most charismatic figures in the whole Irish revolutionary period. And himself and De Valera were on the same side right up until the treaty. Michael Collins is one of the group that went over to London to negotiate the treaty and came back with it. And of course, Éamon de Valera was anti-treaty. So this caused a bitter split between them, which of course ended up
in civil war.
Collins was notorious for giving gifts of guns to people. But this
God, whole, what's wrong with a box of chocolates or a bunch of flowers?
And I used to give them to girls and all. If you upset you, give you a gun. You must have a load of little guns just floating around the place. But this one, it has a huge, it's a devastating impact on Childress because when he's arrested,
his own death.
Yeah, he's found with that gun. Now, the thing is, the government couldn't execute him. They hadn't executed anyone under this legislation. However, there was such a hatred against Erskine Childress by the members of the Free State government. And it was well known. They publicly stated it. But if he was executed with this gun, having been found with this gun, it could be said, oh, well, this is personal. This is revenge. They never liked Erskine Childress. So what happens is, they execute, they choose four lads, unknown IRA men, lads, one of them was only 18. They're executed by firing squad in Comainham Jail on the 17th of November 1922, all the while Erskine Childress is waiting to his fate going to be. Young Erskine is aware of what's going on.
Yeah. Mm.
So he comes back to Ireland.
He was only 16 at the stage.
16
I remember
at the time.
One of the family told me that he was in boarding school when he was, you know, called out by the headmaster. Yeah. He was told, you're going to Ireland. He didn't really know exactly what was happening.
Yeah.
And in the middle of the night, visiting his father in the cell in Beggar's Bush to say
could
goodbye.
Could you imagine the impact of that? One minute you're in boarding school and then you walk into this dank, dark cell and knowing that your father's going to be executed. I mean, can you imagine the profound effect that would have on any young mind?
But that was the whole thing. The four lads that were executed, a week later, Erskine Childress is executed, and it was to show it didn't matter who you were. So it couldn't be levied against the government, oh, you chose Erskine Childress because you don't like him. But young Erskine, it was unusual as well because no family members got to visit their loved ones before their executions in the Civil War. So Erskine is quite unique in that respect. Mm-hmm. And his father, who is going out to meet his executioners, he says to young Erskine, forgive these men.
He did. He said, I want you. So his last wish, his dying wish to his teenage son,
was,
I want you to find and shake the hand of those who signed my death warrant.
Yeah.
And the other promise, I think, wasn't it that he told his son never to speak about the Civil War, and subsequently he never did. He just never talked about it. He never opened up to his family, to his friends, to his colleagues. It just was a subject he never discussed.
But you know what? He wrote about it. There's an extraordinary letter from the files of the Childress family, and it was in the days after Erskine Childress is elected head of state. Here's the incredible thing he talks about. It's the coincidence that, of course, the man who had signed his death warrant, O'Higgins.
Kevin O'Higgins, yeah.
Kevin O'Higgins. His nephew was running in the presidential election in 1973 against the son of the man who was executed, Erskine H. Childers. It's an incredible letter. And he said, Dev was weeping with joy on the phone. He told me I was elected on merit, but nevertheless, the Irish people had expunged at last, in part, the crime of executing father. So the fact that the uncle of the coalition candidate ordered father's execution was never mentioned. He said there was no civil war mention, only the British press mentioned the astounding coincidence. So he was now head of state of the state that had executed his own father 51 years earlier when he was just a teenager.
Yeah,
it's incredible.
That his presidency, it's like the sort of watershed moment in Ireland, because he is sort of that last connection to that generation that their actions created the state that was born out of violence. And he is the direct, he has that direct connection to it because of his father's execution. And, but in 1973, a new Ireland is starting to emerge. We're going a bit from black and white to beige, where the arrival of Erskine Childers, because Ireland is on the cusp of change. They're being forced, if we need to go into the 20th century, not even the 24th century, it's like bring us into the 20th century, and he's part of that. But it's like he's got one foot in one camp and the other foot is in the other camp. It's just, he's like the bridge between the old and new Ireland.
When Erskine was being executed, he was even very courteous, nice.
Oh yeah,
those who were on the firing squad.
Yeah, you are.
He said something like, "Step closer, lads, and make it easier for yourselves." Yeah. I mean, I know we sort of joked about the kind of James Bond line, but I mean, you saw that in a film. You think it was just too. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, he was so dignified.
So I mean, the dignity of the man right until the end was extraordinary.
His cigarette case and his glasses and his watch were stolen.
Yeah,
never returned.
The gun, though, the gun was returned to Erskine and his wife Rita after his death. She actually found the gun and donated it to the National Museum.
Oh, that's where it is.
You can see it in Collins Barracks.
It really brings these objects to life when you know the story behind them, doesn't it?
It does make you think, though. I mean, how difficult it must have been for Hamilton, for Erskine Hamilton, to just to get, break out from the massive shadow of his father. I mean, the shadow of a gunman, literally.
Like, De Valera is in some way responsible for, you know, where, like, Childers Senior's path. And he knows what he's lost.
He carried some guilt, didn't he, about that, Dev?
Yeah. Because at the end of the day, by Dev walking out of the Dáil in January 1922, there would have been a split either way, maybe not in the political sphere, but definitely within the ranks of the IRA. But with the politicians sort of going along with that, you know, it adds fuel to the fire because you've got a political backing of your reasons.
And you can see then why it was that De Valera was encouraging Childers into politics and then perhaps nudging him towards the direction of president.
He really wasn't that interested at first, which is, you know, again, he's not the first president we've talked about that really had to have the hand put behind his back and said, we need you, your country needs you, get up there now. None of your reluctance.
Tell me, what did Erskine Childers look like?
Well, you know, he was a fairly good looking young fella. You know, he's had that very patrician sort of face, I think, very clear features and high cheekbones and those sort of steady eyes of somebody who's never known poverty, if you know that kind of look. And
very high forehead.
He had a very high forehead, yes. And that was fine when he was a young fella. But obviously, as, you know, he aged, and his hair receded to, which my favourite euphemism is to leave a large reflective surface at the top of his head. You know, it did sort of accentuate the size of his head. And it's the first thing you see when you look at photographs of him. Oh, that's perfect for a head of state. If you're going to be a head of state, you should have a big head. But he also had a really large smile. And that's another thing that really strikes you about him. Like, every time you see him, he's got a massive big smile on his face.
Unless he's dealing with the government, in which case that kind of fades a bit.
Well, that's true, yeah. That did. That definitely, that wiped the grin off his face, all right.
So he finished college and went off to Paris, as
he did. Yeah, he finished college. And there's a sense that he ended up going to Paris just to try and get away from Ireland, from the tragedy and the trauma that happened to his father. So he ended up in Paris and he ended up working as a tour guide, which is quite random. And, you know, he was there, he was with his family, he had five children, I don't know whether he had all five at this stage, but he certainly, you know, he'd a large and growing family, let's put it that way. But then he had almost what you could sort of describe as a sliding doors moment. And I have to say here, it just goes to show again that De Valera, like, you just, there's no getting away from the man. Because sure enough, doesn't he get on to him and say, look, I have a job for you back in the Irish press. And he obviously probably needed the money and he thought long and hard about it, was kind of chippied along by his mother. And over then he decides to move lock, stock and barrel over to Dublin.
It's amazing how many of our presidents actually worked in the Irish press. Several of them did and a few more were journalists. There's hope for us yet.
Yeah, there is hope for us yet.
Tell us about his family life.
Yeah, so, I mean, his first wife, we don't really know an awful lot about her. Her name is Ruth Dow, and we do know she was an American heiress. But really, there's very, very little information about who she was. I know it was a very strong marriage, and I know she died, and he was very brokenhearted about it.
But we are lucky in that we do know an awful lot more about his second wife, Ruth Dudley, who he met in 1952. And it's a really interesting story as in how they actually did get married, because they met while she was working in the British Embassy. And then they obviously fell in love. And in 1952, they wanted to get married. And lo and behold, who steps in? Only McQuaid with the cape.
The famous John Charles strikes again.
He's everywhere. And he actually forbade them. He tried to discourage the marriage first because he was a Protestant. She was a Catholic. So that's a big no-no back then. And then he forbade it. He actually forbade them from getting married in Dublin. So they swanned off to France and got married. But she was really supportive of him, encouraged him, drew him out of himself. Certainly when he was actually the president of Ireland. So he was very lucky that the two women in his life were the two loves of his life.
And she was taking on his children from the first marriage as well. So growing up, the republicanism of his father had a real impact on him. And so he was politicised from a young age. But how did he get involved in actual politics?
Reluctantly enough, I think. And I think it was a pretty gradual thing that once he came back, I think he just got drawn into the political coverage and so on. And I think Dev reeled him in very gently. So it was more or less before he knew where he was.
Dev sort of takes him under his wing because he was so fond of his father. But it's the Shannon. It's interesting that it's the Shannon he goes for first, but this is where the issue of his citizenship and, you know, his background comes into play. And that sort of never left him throughout his life. They always threw that against him, that, or used it against him, that he wasn't from Ireland. And under the Citizenship Act in 1935, he was actually able to apply for citizenship. That was only introduced where the child of someone who had citizenship could then apply for citizenship. So that obviously makes a big impact on his political career.
So he eventually
could have played for Ireland in football if he was a handy left back or something, or maybe centre back, maybe let's something like that.
He would have been great at heading the ball. Anyway, we know that. So he eventually runs for politics.
Yeah.
He wins a seat for Fianna Fáil. He's now a health minister eventually. And that was a role he really enjoyed, didn't he?
Yeah, I found this absolutely remarkable that having been reluctant enough to become a Fianna Fáil TD, he took to it like a duck to water. And he ended up, he'd four ministries, including, as you rightly point out, health. And he is on the record many times saying, I really, really loved being health minister, which is a stark contrast to these days. I mean, wasn't it? I think one of our health ministers, Brian Cowan, I think that described the health department as Angola,
somewhere you don't really want to be.
Which is somewhere you definitely don't want to be.
I'd love to go to Angola, actually.
Yeah. So, I mean, this was the thing, like, that he wasn't your classic Fianna Fáiler. I mean, he wasn't part of that sort of shiny suit of brigade, the glad handers and the have their dinner in the middle of the day crowd.
Kissing babies.
And notoriously, in one report, it said that he was famous for never getting his round in, which is, I'm sure, a scandalous falsehood. But, you know, that would be an absolute no-no among Fianna Fáilers, who are a right thirsty lot.
There's actually a lovely quote about him when he was Minister for Health. Because he seems to be a very popular Minister of Health, certainly amongst the doctors and nurses, where a taxi driver said that if the nurses saw St. Patrick on one side of the road and Erskine Childers on the other, they'd ignore St. Patrick because he did nothing, but he'd go straight for Erskine Childers because he did everything for them.
That's right. And that was, you know what? That's a great quote. And funny enough, I think that was said just after he died, you know, as a measure of the respect that people had for him and the affection for him.
We'll be right back after this quick break.
I was very interested, Liz, what you said there about Childers being a bridge from sort of the old revolutionary Ireland into a more modern Ireland. And you actually mentioned the word beige. And, you know, the thing is, while there was some beige around, there was actually sort of colourful stuff happening as well. And in a way, because Childers wanted to sort of be innovative and he wanted to involve young people for the first time, he was tapping into something that was actually going on in Ireland at the time. I mean, for instance, second wave feminism was absolutely up and roaring at this time.
The 1970s.
God bless them all. Let's all burn our bras here in the studio. So you had...
Excuse me, lighter.
So, I mean, you know, we already, a couple of years previously, we'd had that famous, the contraceptive train when 49 bull straps of women, great feminist Nell McCafferty, took the
leading
train
the charge.
Led the charge on the train up to Belfast to buy contraceptives because you weren't allowed to purchase them here. And it was mad, right? The hall went up, huge zoo of cameras and everything like that. They all marched into a few pharmacies to buy contraceptives and then found a needed prescription. So undaunted, they just bought a pile of aspirin and loads of condoms, back down the train, came off the train waving all these, taking the aspirins in front of the guards and all that. It did sort of start the conversation, I suppose, about contraception. And the interesting thing is that protest took place that just after a young senator had her fourth attempt to put through a bill to legalise contraception fail on her. And that was Mary Robinson. So, you know, also at that time you had the marriage bar finally removed, like an albatross around the neck of every right thinking woman in the country. Because, you know, this had been something that was put in place back in 1925 by Ernest Bligh, who was the Minister for Finance at the time. And there it sat. It squatted like a gargoyle.
You kept adding to it.
Yeah.
And you can't. You have to leave. You have to leave.
Make great way for a young man.
Get them all out. Teachers, everybody, right? None of that.
Get back into young men's jobs.
Yeah. Get back into the kitchen, you women. I mean,
I have to just, this is that remind me, there's a great quote, Kathleen Clark, when they're talking about the Conditions of Employment Bill, which leads to that whole putting women in the home.
Oh, she was our first Lord Mayor, who was a woman.
First Lady Lord Mayor. But she said in the Dáil debate, or Shannon debate, that she says, the minister, if you can actually say that the types of jobs that women are going to take from the men, if it's that you want to have women scrubbing floors, I gladly support this. But it won't be, will it?
And I was reading that she was the 626th Lord Mayor of Dublin and the first woman.
Oh, my God almighty. That's absolutely, that's mad.
Also in the 70s, didn't we have the wonderful invasion of the 40s?
Oh, I love the story so much. I love the story so much. Yeah.
I wish I'd been there.
I so wished I'd been there. It was like July 1974 and a bunch of women known as the Dublin City Women's Invasion Force, which I think we should definitely bring back. Anyway, they all fetched up out of the blue down in the 40-foot, which is a well-known bathing area in South County Dublin, very genteel. That was men only until that point. But the thing was, there wasn't actually any law. This was just a unilateral decision, no women allowed. So anyway, another
because
one...
Because the men were swimming in their birthday suits.
Because the men were all swimming in their pelt. So a load of women suddenly piled in and consternation broke out. And there's some absolutely fantastic descriptions of what went on. Like there was, the men started, you know, waving their genitalia, was as it was put at them, and which could be, you know, scary or not, depending, I suppose, on the temperature of the day. And I remember listening to Rosita Sweetman, another member of the tribe, and, you know, she was on Liveline only last year, and she was talking about, you know, how owlfellas were walloping the young feminists wet towels and screaming at them. Of course, this caused, you know, great consternation. And but that was that. That was the end of it. From that point on, women were able to, you know, able to swim in the 40-foot. Ireland was really in transition. And that is why Erskine Childers just came along at the right time to sort of tap into A bit of the modern and, you know, getting people involved in, you know, in decision making and so on. So he was the right man at the right time.
How did he become president? What was that? What led to it?
Well, it was really, again, he got the tap, you know, he was tapped on the shoulder and said, you know, we need a candidate. And he was the chosen one for the party.
He felt that he didn't have complete backing of Fianna Fáil, didn't he?
Well, again, it goes back to that thing. He was sort of seen as a bit of an outsider, and they didn't expect him to win. I mean, this is the point. He really was the underdog in this race because he was up against the favourite, which was Fine Gael's Tom O'Higgins. And actually, you could probably argue, in a way, they were two Nepo babies, really, because Tom was came from the line of Kevin O'Higgins and that great, you know, figure. And of course, Steve in politics. We've already talked about Erskine's dad. So, you know, he went out on the campaign trail, really. And all the Fianna Fáilers said, "Ash, look, we'll give him a run. It takes the bear look off the ballot." But they didn't expect what happened next.
And he won by 48,000 votes. He mentions that actually in the brilliant letter that he wrote in the days after his election victory. And he wrote this letter to his son, Erskine. And it's really funny. He has just been elected. And so it's still all very much in his head. He said, "We drove 4,700 miles around Ireland, stopped 650 times, and I made 250 speeches. The welcome became more and more enthusiastic. I was mobbed by young girls and women. One woman said to Rita, 'Look after him, he's precious. I haven't been so moved since Elvis.'" Hers was not an isolated remark.
That's okay. When you asked me earlier to describe him, I have to say Elvis definitely did not spring into my mind in any shape or form.
But they called it the election bus. They called it the Wanderley wagon. And it was the first time that there was such a presidential election in Ireland with a bus travelling the country like that.
The Wanderley wagon. I haven't heard that in years. Of course, that was just this like really cute kids TV show.
Every Saturday morning.
And the sort of theme song used to go something like, I'm not singing it, but it certainly went, you know, here comes
the wagon.
Yeah. And funny enough, I used to hear it every time I walked into a room. I never understood why. I mean, Flora, you and I have been on enough campaign trails to know the madness of it, right? It's like a rolling Tasmanian devil. I mean, there's, you know, this sort of cloud of dust going down the road with fists and arms coming out of it.
It's like a rock and roll tour without the music.
Yeah, or without the good looking people most of the time. But, you know, and Brian Lennon, who was looking after his campaign, who of course was, you know, a Fianna Fáil minister, who actually fancied it, killed at the job. Yeah, and we'll talk about him again. But he was in despair about him because he just wasn't the baby-kissing type. And I think there was babies thrust at him and he'd just sort of look at them and put them down gently on the ground, you know? I mean, Fianna Fáil should have been warned that they were faced with a different class of animal now with Erskine Childers, because on the day that he was actually officially endorsed as their candidate, he told a press conference, he said, "I have consented to be the candidate on the understanding that if I am elected, I will be able to expand the dimension and character of the presidency and only on that condition."
Yes.
So they knew what they were getting.
They did. And he was determined to be a progressive president, to open up the Oros. I mean, he was really farsighted. He was thinking ahead. I saw another quote where he said, you know, we need to think as far as 1990. Which was, I think, 17 years later than when he was elected. But he wanted to have think tanks. That's not an easy thing for Cork people to say.
Think tanks, girl.
He was also determined to involve young people in the work he was doing at the Oros. He wanted to have a youth forum, and that was shot down by Cosgrave's government.
Yeah, and he does seem to want to bring the youth on. Like on Olga, the youth hostel sort of movement all across Ireland, he was fully supportive of that and wants to actually expand it. But I suppose if we go back to his beginnings, like he was 17 in 1923 when he speaks at a Sinn Féin election campaign just as the Civil War ends. So he himself had, at such a young age, had that taste of politics, which then obviously leads him on the journey to becoming the eventual president of Ireland. But he is very progressive. And think of it, in the first couple of months, over 1,000 people had visited the Oros.
Which is like an extraordinary
number.
We
think today, you just go up to the Oros, no bother. But it actually was a very closed off space. He begins that, which, like, the President of Ireland represents the people. That is our space. But he's the one to start that.
You'd have to wonder what else he would have tried to do to open up the Irish if he hadn't been...
It is the great unknown.
Yeah. And I mean, I think he did...
lost his life so soon. Yeah.
Yeah, and he did get very frustrated with this. I mean, he was giving policy speeches. He literally talked an awful lot about the environment as well.
Yeah.
And some of the things he was saying, you know, were raising eyebrows in government buildings. And, you know, he also, there's a sense that he was getting very frustrated with the limitations, the constitution limitations of the job. So you would have to wonder if he had actually lived out his full term, you know, would he have ended up in at loggerheads with the government all the time? Or, I mean, let's not forget, I mean, the presidency was still reasonably, a still fairly new institution. Mm. You know, might they have rewritten the rules slightly to expand his powers? I mean, it's just, there are questions to you.
They
just
reined
to,
him in on northern issues as yeah. well, didn't they?
Yeah, they actually, the Cosgrave government limited his powers because he did speak out in the north with the explosion of the violence in the north. And this continues, like, that link with his father, that he is trying to sort of come and find a solution to lead to a united Ireland. And he spoke out on the violence that was being carried out down in the south as well as in the north, like the Dublin Monaghan bombings. He famously attended the funerals of the victims yeah. of Dublin Monaghan.
I was horrified by the...
Totally horrified. Like, he is, again, he knows what violence leads to. He had experienced that yeah. personally, and the trauma, it's intergenerational trauma yeah. But he spoke out saying that the violence, he could never see United Ireland with this violence, and the Cosgrave government, like, you've still overstepped the mark.
And this and the thing was, Liz, I mean, this is at a time when violence was rampant, not only in the north, I mean, which has been torn apart, but down here, you know, yeah. in the Republic mm-hmm. as well. I mean, you had, and they were, it was often things that were, I suppose, what's the word? Not daring, but they were actually operating with impunity. I mean, if you look back even to some of the headline-grabbing ones, you had, you know, the Mountjoy prison escape, which yeah. made headlines around the world,
yeah.
where a helicopter literally landed in Mountjoy and three IRA, you know, prominent IRA members...
Locked off the roof.
You know, literally yeah. took off in it.
Sorry, but there is a funny story about that where the prison guard says, close the gate.
Close the gates.
Don't need them, love.
In May 1974, Sir Alfred and Lady Clementine Bite, who were one of the ascendancy families, and they lived in this
beautiful Rusborough house.
Beautiful Rusborough house down in County Wicklow. And an armed IRA gang led by British heiress turned IRA gunwoman, Rose Dugdale. Yeah, broke in and made off with 19 masterpieces. And these are by, like, Rubens and Gainsborough and the only privately held Vermeer in the world. I mean, again, just like the helicopter caper, if you want to call it that.
Audacious
and made headlines around the world. And this is at a time when you had a president who was sitting there talking about peace and reconciliation as well. He was constantly saying, let's try and, you know, do cross-border cooperation on things like trade, agriculture. So all the time he was literally trying to build bridges. The IRA were blowing them up.
Do you say he invented podcasting?
Well, that's a little known fact, and I'm glad you asked me that, Flor. So while he was Minister for Post and Telegraphs, he took a huge interest in the broadcasting service, and he made a very important decision. He allowed an innovation at that time of unscripted discussions on controversial topics on Radio Éireann. So, I mean, what else is the podcast except that's exactly what it is.
And, you know, in the same way, he was also trying to get the archives and government archives opened up and made available to the public, yeah. which was transparency, as we now call it.
He's way ahead of his time in so many things. He really is. Like, even he was talking about road widening schemes. Like, he was really aware of roads safety when people weren't thinking about it. And building, like, taking the road building out of the hands of the local authority and having it as a national government policy. And you look at where joining the EEC, which happens, you know, yes, around 83. This time, that's it. You know, we get all our roads built, national roads built with the help of European money. It's like he has a little, like, you know, crystal ball into the future and can see what the potential can be for Ireland.
And then, of course, there was the speech, the famous one he was making November the 17th, 1974, just after which he collapsed and died. But on the progressive nature of his presidency. The speech was in the Royal College of Physicians in Dublin, and he was talking to the audience about the overprescription of medication to Irish women.
And it's when you think of that time, this is when all these housing estates were being built in Dublin, the outer suburbs of Dublin, where people were actually lifted from the NRC, close communities, and just put outside in the sticks with no connection to anything. And that had a huge impact on a lot of women's mental health. So
he was thinking of that too.
Yeah, yeah.
So Flor, his death, I mean, it wasn't just sudden, but it was a really public death as well.
Oh, it was just really, really terribly sad. So he had just finished this speech where he suffered sudden heart failure. He fell sideways at the podium in the Royal College of Physicians. His 16-year-old daughter, Nessa, was in the audience in the front row. She ran to try and catch him, and he was pronounced dead that same afternoon in the Mater Hospital in Dublin.
I mean, the nation literally went into total shock. You know, they'd chosen this man and they'd taken him into their heart, like their hearts. They really warmed to him. And he was gone just in such a short time. And of course, he was given a full state funeral. And the crowds flocked to St. Patrick's Cathedral to see him lying in state.
It was the largest gathering of heads of state and monarchs ever on the island of Ireland.
That's right. And, you know, at a time of great political strain, I suppose, British Prime Minister Harold Wilson showed up and it was actually accompanied by Lord Mountbatten. And of course, he came to a sad end a few years later as well. They estimated when on one evening alone, something like 15,000 people went literally filed past his coffin in the cathedral. And apparently, St. Patrick's Street at 11 o'clock that night was just as busy as it was during the day. People were genuinely shocked by it and they really felt it very deeply.
But wasn't there talk of Rita Childers possibly becoming president, taking over?
There was, and she would have become our first woman president.
Well,
which would have been, you know, remarkable. Actually, the political parties, they secretly agreed to make her the new president. And unfortunately, and it was just by complete accident, this secret deal leaked when a journalist put a question to a TD who was partially deaf, and he misheard the question and he spilled out the whole story. Then Fianna Fáil took fright and said, OK, both, everybody took fright and said, definitely, no, we can't go with this now. I mean, it was more or less a done deal, and it just collapsed by accident.
Bloody journalists,
I know. Of course, I mean, so, you know, that lucky soul had like a fantastic story. But of course, the fact that her, you know, her bid to replace her husband fell at the last minute actually opened the door to her successor, Ciara Ó Dálaigh, who we'll be talking about next time. And I suppose one kind of sad irony was that when you look at the papers from that day, his funeral in some cases was actually completely overshadowed, and this is such a sad irony, was it was the same day as the Birmingham bombings. And when two pubs in Birmingham were obliterated by IRA bombs and 21 people were killed. And
that became the big story.
Yeah, over 180 people injured, and that became the great story, which is really ironic given the fact that this was a president that was sort of, you know, forged out of the bitter revolutions of Ireland and spent his entire short presidential career and before really just trying to promote peace and reconciliation, understanding among people. And yet, the very day that he was buried, you know, the carnage was continuing. Next time. He was supposed to have said that he was an effing bollocks, a thundering bollocks.
A thundering disgrace.
That's definitely, yeah. That would have me out the door in absolute high dudgeon.
You've been listening to Think You Know, The Presidents, a Today FM production presented by The Last Word.
Presented by Lees Hand and Flor McCarthy with historian Liz Gillis. Researched by Lees Hand, Flor McCarthy and Siobhan Maguire. Recorded by Thomas Balp and Stephen McLoone. Sound designed by Neil Kavanagh and produced by Siobhan Maguire.
Archive clips from president.ie. A huge thanks to The Last Word and wider Today FM team. You can follow us on Go Loud, Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoyed this, please give us a like and a review.